And welcome to the course Fascinating Facts. This is a course which is put out by an organization in New York. It's called the Jewish Learning Institute. And this Jewish Learning Institute brings these courses together, which are then presented in several hundred locations across the globe. This is today the largest Jewish adult education system. This is the Jewish Learning Institute. And this is the first of three courses which will be given this year. Each course is 6 weeks. The courses, I'm assuming most of you know, these courses are given Sunday mornings at the Beis Chabad Torah Center at 11 o'clock, Thursday evenings here, and you can feel free to alternate based on what your schedule allows. There should be enough books. There is a possibility we will run out of books, in which case I will make sure to have more books by next week. So hopefully we will have enough. All right, so today's topic, let's jump right into it. Today's topic is Fascinating Facts, Discovering the Myths and Mysteries of Judaism. So the story is told about an individual, a non-Jewish individual, is traveling on a train with a Jewish person. And he's sitting next to him, and he says to him, he says, "Tell me, what is the secret? You hear all the time about Jewish people being so smart. What is the secret of the wisdom of the Jewish people?" And the man says, "I'll tell you." He says, "The secret is that we eat herring." He says, "Herring." He says, "Wow, that's the secret." So sure enough, a little while later, the Jewish man takes out his little package of food, and there's herring there. He says, "Some herring." So the man next to him says, "Tell me, you have extra herring? You can maybe sell me some herring?" He says, "Absolutely." He says, "How much?" He says, "I'll sell you for 20 rubles a piece." Very expensive. He says, "20 rubles a piece of herring." He says, "Okay." He takes out 20 rubles. He gives it to him, and he tastes a bit of the herring. He says, "Yeah, I can get the same herring in Moscow for 5 rubles. He says, "Look, you're so smart already, you see." So, we talk about fascinating facts, and we're going to learn. It's a 6-week course, and those of you who have participated in previous courses, I know last year we had some fascinating discussions of medical ethics and the meaning of life, which were deeper. This is a course which should be lighter, entertaining. It's not necessarily focused on one area. We will go from area to area, discussing various topics in Judaism. And just to give a brief rundown of the 6 weeks and the 6 topics discussed. The course is formed in such a way that every topic, every week is a self-standing complete topic, so that you can, if you miss a week or you miss a couple weeks, you haven't missed the course. Each week you come, you walk away with something complete. So the first topic to be discussed will be the story of your life. We'll start from the beginning, discussing the Bible, the Torah. The second week, we will go through exploring the Jewish life cycle. That will be next week, as well as next Sunday and next Thursday. The third discussion will be under the influence, angels, blessings, and evil eyes, the mystical aspects of life, the mystical aspects of Judaism. Should be a fascinating discussion. The fourth discussion, taking a bite out of life, kosher food facts. Kosher food is as integral a part of Judaism as anything else, food, right? So we'll discuss the fascinating facts and myths in connection to foods. The fifth discussion will be that regarding Hebrew. It's all Hebrew to me, the translation of the words, the many secrets contained in the language. And finally, beyond the nose job. Right? Okay? Judaism's answer to life's biggest question. And we will go into that in the 6 classes. I'd like to mention also that please, if you have any idea or a question which you may have, feel free to email me. I hope that most of you received an email before this class with a preview or a preface of that. If not, please let me know afterwards so I can get your email address to keep you informed. We signed the preview as well as a review of the class. The class is also recorded so that in the event you can't make it, you should be able to hear it online. Now, when discussing fascinating facts, I want to clarify how this course will be, because really when you talk about trivia or fascinating facts, you can go from one thing to the next, and it's just random different facts. The most babies are born in which month? The month of August. And that there are twice as many bicycles in the world as cars. And we can go a whole day just discuss random ideas, which is nice, is interesting, but you don't necessarily walk away with anything concrete. So too with Jewish facts, there are all sorts of Jewish facts. If you go into Google and you search fascinating Jewish facts, the results are, by and large, are actors and singers and entertainers who are Jewish. That is the overwhelming response. Is the fascinating fact is, you know, this person is Jewish and that person is Jewish. That is some crazy facts which I can't believe to be correct or to be true. But that's a different idea of facts, right? There's all sorts of statistics. They say that 89.4% of statistics are made up on the spot. Right? So instead of simply going from one fact to the next, what we're going to do, and we'll see this today, is we'll take specific areas and we'll find out something unique and interesting, but we'll focus on it and explain what the reason behind it and perhaps the value and the message and the lesson to it. And then we'll throw in an idea from time to time, a different fact here and there, which we will do as well. Obviously, questions and arguments and dialogue is more than welcome. It will keep us all awake, although we'll try to keep things within the context so we don't go completely off topic. The way we go through the course, those of you who have not participated in any of these classes, there are texts in the book, and we will go around the table as go from person to person to read those texts. You are more than welcome to pass. If you would rather not read, you're more than welcome to pass it on. You could read in the Hebrew or the English as you wish. And that is how we will go through the course. We have to go through the course. So we open today with the very beginning, with the discussion of what is the Torah. Before we dive into Jewish fascinating facts, and we go through the six areas of Judaism, it will most likely would be best to start with the beginning, with the Torah. What is the source of Jewish knowledge? Source of Jewish knowledge, we are aware of, is the Torah. But what is the Torah? What is the Bible? Now, oh, you know what? I forgot about this. We have a, before we begin, there is a short video introduction to this course. This is a video with a riddle. The riddle is perhaps an easier riddle. And when you figure it out, you can keep it to yourself so we don't lose the sense of the rest of us. Okay. All right, so I'm assuming most people were able to get that at some point in the riddle. That was the easiest one tonight, so prepare yourself. Okay, so we open with a discussion of the Bible. Some fast facts about the Bible. The Bible, without a doubt, is the all-time best seller. In fact, the Bible has been translated into 2,500 languages. I didn't know 2,500 languages existed, but 2,500 languages the Bible has been translated into. Anybody want to venture a guess as to how many copies of the Bible have been printed?
10.
Okay, you're not that far off. The Bible, I'm not sure who exactly counted, but the Bible has been translated, has been copied 6 billion times. Whoever is the author is making a good living off of this. So this is the Bible is the all-time bestseller. In fact, the word Bible comes from the Greek word, I believe this is Greek, biblion, which means the book. So Bible has become so, it's such a, this is the staple of all books, that this is the book. So if you want to have, today, if you go into the store, you'll find the Bible of cooking, or the Bible of another topic, because this has come to represent the foundation of a topic. The Bible. And yet, when we talk about the Bible, there is a significant misunderstanding as to what the Bible is. In fact, most people, when you ask, what is the Bible, you'll hear two responses. If you think as a Jew, if someone asks you, what is the Bible, or one will ask, what is the Torah? All right, any suggestion? What would you answer to that question? All right, so when I posed the question, I'm sorry, you're looking like you want to answer. When I posed that question last week on campus, I said, what's the Torah? So we got two responses. One response is the book of laws. And the second response was it's a book of Jewish history. The problem is that both of these seem to be incorrect. It can't be a book of Jewish law because there is significantly more to the Torah than law. If you today, as we read through the Torah in the synagogue, every week we are reading, so this week we are going to read about the birth of Isaac. An entire Torah portion. In fact, the entire first book of Torah, the first of the five books, there are no laws whatsoever. It's not a book of laws at all. The laws really begin in the middle of the second book. So the natural reaction is, okay, so it's a book of Jewish history. It begins with the creation of the world, and then we spend a lot of time discussing Abraham, the first Jew. It's a book of Jewish history. That's the natural response. The Torah is a book of history, and that's why the discussion of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the tribes. But if it is indeed a book of history, it is a lousy history book. And the reason is, as you see on page number 2, chart number 1.1, that the Torah, if you count the history, is missing significant chunks of history. If you look through the Torah, you read through it, and you can see the little chart on the board, the first 11 chapters of the Torah cover 2,018 years. It's interesting that Abraham was born in the year 1948. We talk about Israel being established in 1948. Abraham, if you start from creation, was born in the year 1948. So the first 11 chapters of Torah, which cover the first two Torah portions of 52, cover 2,018 years. The next 41 chapters of Torah, you see in the Torah, which talk about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the tribes, cover 429 years. 11 chapters for 2,000 years, 41 chapters for 430 years. The next 83 chapters, which covers Exodus, the entire book of Leviticus, and a portion of the book of Numbers, covers 2 years for the Jewish people, the first 2 years they were in the desert. And then the final 52 chapters covers 11 months. So, taking this, if you would want to, so this is the Jewish, this, the history of the Torah is completely inconsistent, right? It begins with 11 chapters discussing 2,000 years. In fact, if you want to break it down further, the first 52 chapters cover 2,500 years, and the next 135 chapters cover 3 years. So what type of history book is that? This doesn't cover history at all. If you would take this into equation, try to compare this with American history, so that would be the equivalent of a book, just as the Torah is made up of 187 chapters. So imagine an American history book with 187 chapters, and 135 of the chapters are dedicated to 4 months of American history. That would be the equivalent in American history, which tells you that the Torah is not a very good history book at all. In fact, I want to skip. I know this is we're going to skip. I want to go first to text 1B and then move to text 1A. Text 1B on page 4. So then we'll go around the table. Again, if you're comfortable reading, it's great. If not, you're welcome to pass it on to the next one. We'll start. Go ahead. Text 1B.
Woe to the person who says that the Torah's objective is merely to relate stories and simplistic tales. If the object of the Torah were to relate historical matters, the rulers of the world have historical chronicles that are superior. Let us utilize that and produce
This is what the Zohar says. The Zohar, which is root of the Kabbalah, says that it's ridiculous to assume that the Torah simply tells us where we came from and the history of how it all began and how we were led to Egypt and led out of Egypt. We have better historical documents which would suffice. And in history we do. We have even, I've heard perhaps more recently, we have Josephus, different books of history which are better, and therefore one cannot assume the Torah is a history book. At the same time, it's not a book of laws, because as we pointed out, the first entire book of five, there's no laws whatsoever. The laws begin at Sinai. The laws begin when the Jewish people leave Egypt. So if it's not a book of history, and it's not a book of laws, what is it? What is the Torah? What is it intended to be? You know, you go to school, there's in college, it's very clear, this is a book for math, this is a book for language, this is a book for English. What is the Torah? So, I'm sorry, a guide. So for this, we go back to text 1A, which directs something which is not necessarily laws, but very similar. And this is a very important idea, which many people forget. Even those who know what Torah is sometimes forget this idea. What is Torah? Text 1A.
Torah guides people along the path they must take in order to reach their greatest potential. It is therefore appropriately called Torah, which implies guidance.
That's right. Torah, the root of the word Torah, is the same root as the word Hora'ah, which means guidance. The Hebrew word for a teacher is mora or moreh. And therefore, when we study Torah, the message is, even if it's not a law, so we go through the book of Genesis, creation, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I can't look at this and simply say, well, this is a nice story. Every part of Torah is a story, is a message for me, is a lesson for me. Which explains why the first, going back to that chart, why the first 2,000 years are covered in 11 chapters, because even though it's a part of history, but there isn't as much to deduce, there isn't much guidance in life to be taken from that history. So the Torah doesn't spend time on it. But there are sometimes very, what seems to be insignificant events, which are described in detail. Some of you may be familiar with the story of Jacob and the sheep and the speckled sheep and the striped sheep, which Torah describes in great detail. In the book of Numbers, Moses counts the Jewish people three times. Every time he counts the Jewish people, the counting is described in great detail. Which seems to be insignificant. But the reason is there must be some sort of lesson in life. And every time I read a story in Torah, I have to walk away and ask myself, what is the lesson that I can take from this? And this is perhaps, you know, this is perhaps the most important message we should walk away from. As we open a Torah is a lesson. And every story has to carry within it a lesson. And what's interesting is that not only is there a lesson in what is mentioned in Torah, many times a portion of Torah which is omitted, if there's an area of something which is not mentioned, that too carries within it a lesson. And we'll jump to the first example on page 5. We have a tale of two trees. Okay, so before we get into the text over here, perhaps someone could suggest or help us out here. The tree of knowledge, the very first sin between Adam and Eve, which caused all sorts of problems throughout the rest of history. So the tree of knowledge, what was the fruit that Adam ate? An apple. Right? We all know it's an apple. Problem is that Torah doesn't mention the fruit at all. And in fact, in the Talmud there is a discussion as to what the fruit may be, but there is no opinion which says it was an apple. And we'll discuss where the idea of an apple, not only an apple today, we know there's the idea of an Adam's apple. There's an apple juice company called Adam and Eve's apple juice. Everyone knows it was the fruit, the tree, it was an apple tree, which is incorrect. Where did an apple come from? And, first of all, where did the myth of an apple come from? And secondly, why doesn't Torah tell us what that fruit was? It describes everything around the sin aside for what the fruit was. So, it's unclear exactly where this apple came from, but perhaps it's as follows. The first translation of the Torah was, the first time the Torah was translated into a different language was Greek. Talmai, the King Talmai, gathered together 70 sages, and Talmai took these 70 Jewish sages and put them into 70 different rooms. And he said, I want you each to translate the Torah into, in your words, into Greek. This way he wanted to be certain that there wouldn't be any conspiracy to change anything in the Torah. So he had 70 sages, each one put into their own room. He said, no texting, everyone has to write the Torah on their own, and you'll see what the translation would be. Now, interestingly, the Talmud discusses how, by some divine providence, all 70 recognized certain specific areas which needed to be changed. One of the most important examples is that in the Torah, we begin the Torah with the words Bereshis, Bara, Elohim, in the beginning God created, which can be misleading to mean Bereshis, Bara, Elohim, that some concept called Bereshis, Bara, created God, which may lead to some mistaken understanding. So therefore, they translated a little bit differently, saying Elohim, Bara, Bereshis, that God created in the beginning. So there wouldn't be any room for misunderstanding. The point is that there were differences that they all recognized should be made without having any communication. So the Torah was first translated into Greek by Talmai. This must have been right around the beginning of the Common Era, I'd imagine. Perhaps if someone knows the exact years, please correct. And then later it was translated by a man named Jerome or Geronimus into Latin. The Latin word malus means evil. The Latin word malus also means an apple tree. So, perhaps, again, this is all speculation, but perhaps this is the root of the idea that an apple tree is connected to evil, and therefore, somehow the sin, which is not described in Torah, so it was left up for the interpretation, so therefore they interpreted it as an apple tree, perhaps. I don't know. This is the one speculation of what may be the root of this. Because, let's read text number 2. In the Torah itself, there is no identification of what the fruit is at all. Text number 2 on page number 5.
Go ahead. Yeah. And the Lord caused to sprout from the ground every tree that was pleasant to see and good to eat, and in the midst of the garden, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And the Lord God commanded man, saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, obscure of knowledge of good and evil, you shall not, for you shall surely die in the day that you eat thereof.
Now we were thinking of putting up a slide of the sin. Problem is that at that period in time, Adam and Eve weren't wearing any clothing. And all the paintings of that event managed to remember that detail, that they weren't wearing any clothing. So perhaps it was inappropriate to make a slide with the picture of the sin. But this is a sin. If you read in the Torah, it says very clearly. It says that there's a tree of knowledge. It doesn't say what it was. In the Talmud, the sages tried to deduce what it was. So text 3a, we have a discussion in the Talmud as to what the fruit may have been.
The tree from which Adam ate, Rabbi Meir says it was a grapevine. Rabbi Nechemiah says it was a fig tree. Rabbi Yehuda says it was a wheat stalk.
So you have several opinions. Each one has a calculation. You know, interestingly, the Michelangelo's painting on the Sistine, the roof of Sistine Chapel, and the sin, he has a fig. He has the sin of Adam and Eve happening with the fig. It's interesting. Not much of his work, there was some, seems to be, he had some very specific Jewish knowledge regarding some of the details. And that's what he has, a fig over there. But over here you have difference in opinion, because the Torah doesn't clarify. So one opinion says it was a grape. Why? Not because Torah says so, simply because if the Torah doesn't identify fruit, which fruit causes the most trouble throughout history? Most of our mistakes, or many mistakes, are the outcome of the produce of a grape. It is the grape, which reduces one's difference for the assumption. It doesn't describe it. It must have been a grape. The second opinion, which says a fig, says the interesting reason is because when they sinned, it says then they recognized that they were embarrassed of their nakedness, and therefore, what did they say? They took leaves from the fig tree. So this opinion says, why a fig tree? Basically, it says that this was where the mistake came from, so that's where the solution came from as well. The solution came from the same tree where they made a mistake. That was the tree which allowed them to use their leaves to cover themselves. But this is Talmudic discussion. The Torah doesn't identify the tree. And you'd think this would be a very significant detail. What was the fruit? What was the fruit of knowledge? But as we said before, that Torah is Horah. Torah is a lesson. The lesson is in everything. The lesson is in what it says. The lesson could be in what it doesn't say. You know, there's a line that sometimes you have the idea that the silence is deafening. Right? Sometimes just by not saying something, there could be a greater impression. And over here, there's an impression to be made by the Torah omitting what the fruit was. What is that impression? The Talmud says, the Medrash actually says in text 3b. Go ahead. Page number 6.
Rabbi Azaria and Rabbi Yehuda ben Simon, that is the name of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Heaven forbid, God never revealed the identity of the tree to any man, and he never will.
So he says it was intentionally omitted, and the reason is as follows. Because the Torah is teaching a lesson in sensitivity. The Torah says there's really two reasons connected here. First of all, the Torah doesn't want to identify a certain fruit with sin. So that this fruit throughout all of history, I mean, just today, you hear about an apple is connected to that sin. So the Torah wouldn't want to put down a fruit, and if the Torah would identify this is the source of all sin, the very first sin, so forever that fruit would be linked to a mistake. But perhaps even more importantly, is that if we would know the specific fruit that Adam and Eve sinned with, so every time we would come in contact with that fruit, we would remember the mistake of Adam and Chava. And every time it would cast a shadow of evil on Adam and Eve, we would remember, our Bubby and Zadie, this is the mistake they made. Whenever we eat an apple, we would think that. So therefore, the Torah chooses not to tell us what the fruit was. There is no fruit which constantly reminds us of the mistake of someone. And the lesson, obviously, is a lesson in sensitivity. If someone did something wrong, we shouldn't remind them. There's many different laws regarding not reminding a person of a mistake they may have made out of sensitivity to them. Even if it's, well, many years later, one shouldn't remind them of their mistake. And this is the lesson of Torah not mentioning the fruit. Now, some of you may be thinking, you know, the apple is really not a very big detail. Perhaps the Torah doesn't mention it simply because it's insignificant. It's not a significant detail. So here, the response to that is that we find a little while later, another instance of a tree where the Torah goes to great detail to describe exactly what the tree was. What is that a reference? When did that happen? So they go to text 4, the next book of Torah. This is when God first introduces himself to Moses, right? Introduces himself in a bush, and text 4a describes what exactly this tree or this bush that God first reveals himself to Moses was. Text 4a.
An angel of God appeared to Moses in the heart of a fire in the midst of the thorn bush. He looked and behold, the thorn bush was ablaze. The thorn bush was now consumed.
So it doesn't say God revealed or the angel revealed to Moses in a tree. It says specifically a thorn bush. Then it describes again a thorn bush. Then Moses looks at the thorn bush. It's an extra word. It was a thorn bush. Why is the Torah describing the nature of the tree? Now, if we, once again, this is based on the principle that the Torah is God's word. So there is no such thing as just randomly chose to say the type of tree. You know, when we speak, so yeah, one time I will mention the type of tree it was, one time I won't, maybe I will mention the color, the next conversation I won't. The Torah is the word of God. Everything is exact. The fact that by the tree of knowledge it doesn't mention the type of fruit, and by this tree it does mention, is specific. So what is the message that in this episode the Torah describes exactly what type of tree it was? Text 4b, we have from Rashi. Rashi, his name is Shlomo Yitzchaki, who is perhaps the most important commentary of the last several thousand years, who writes the commentary which is goes hand in hand with Torah, goes hand in hand with the Talmud. Rashi is the one who gives us the simple understanding of Torah and Talmud. So, what does he explain? Why does the Torah describe it as a thorn bush? Text 4b, please.
From within the thorn bush and not any other type of tree, because I am within the thorn bush.
All right, so the message is, God reveals himself to Moses in a thorn bush. This is in the desert. The Jewish people at that time are enslaved in Egypt. God says, I am in a thorn bush. I am in pain together with them. And this is a message, a very powerful lesson, which continues till today. In moments of pain, in moments of struggle, we may not understand why we struggle. We may not understand why God put us in this situation. But God reminds us, Imo Anochi Vetzara, I am with them in their pain. And therefore, I'm revealing to you in a thorn bush, in a fiery thorn bush, a thorn bush which is a painful place to be. And that's why the Torah there does describe who it was. Now they say the story about our previous president, George W. He was walking through the desert and he sees in the distance a man with a long white beard, and he recognizes from the pictures, this is Moses. So he goes over, he runs over to him, he says, Moses, Moses, I'm the president. So I want to say hello to you, but Moses ignores him completely. So he goes over and he walks around to him, he taps him on the shoulder. He says, you know, hi, it's me. Ignores him. Finally says, why are you ignoring me? He says, last time I spoke to a bush, I spent 40 years wandering the desert. I'm not going to try. So, this is an example how we study a message, even these insignificant details, seemingly insignificant details. Each detail has within it a message, and that's what Torah is. Torah is a book of lessons. And even when it doesn't clearly say the law, you should do this or you shouldn't do this, there's a lesson, a life lesson that can be taken from it. Sometimes they're harder to decipher, sometimes they're more easy to decipher. Okay, so we'll move on now. On page number 8, this is a topic called the writing on the wall. The writing on the wall is a common phrase which is used when we sense the impending doom or we sense how something's not going to work out. So we see the writing on the wall, the handwriting on the wall. Where does this come from? This is a Jewish concept and it's based on a biblical story in Tanakh. And the story is as follows. The king Belshazzar was a grandson of Nebuchadnezzar who destroyed the first temple and took the many vessels from within it with him to Babylon. And his grandson makes a feast. Interestingly, he makes this feast because the prophecy of Jeremiah had not come to fruition in his calculation. Jeremiah said the Jewish people will be in exile for 70 years. And 7 years, in his understanding, had passed, and therefore he made a celebration, and a major part of the celebration was taking the vessels from the Holy Temple and using them as part of the party. At that moment, during the middle of the party, literally a hand was seen, just a hand, was seen writing words on the wall. The words were, perhaps you can, I don't know if they have it here in English, page number 8, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Ufarsin. These were the words written on the wall, just with a hand. As a child, I tried once convincing my parents that the mess in the room, there was just a hand which appeared out of nowhere and made a mess. The handwriting on the wall wrote these words, and nobody understood what those words meant. One of the commentaries says the reason they didn't understand was, I mean, the different understandings why, different opinions as to what was so complicated, is it was that it was, the letters were one language, but the words were another language. So imagine you would write an English word in Russian with Russian letters. An English word with Russian letters, or vice versa, a Russian word in English letters. So those who speak Russian wouldn't understand it because it's an English word. Those who speak English wouldn't understand it because it's Russian letters. So those who say that's why nobody understood it, they called in, who was the scholar at that time who worked for the king, was Daniel. Daniel was one of the advisors, and he was called in, and he explained what the words meant. He said, Mene means to count. Mene again means to recount. Tekel is to weigh, ufartin and to divide. He says, God has calculated and recalculated your actions. He has weighed them and recognized that your actions are incorrect, are evil, and therefore, ufartin, your kingdom will be divided. That very night, Belshazzar was assassinated, and his kingdom was then split up into Media and Persia. That night. So this is the, just interesting idea. This is the source of the idea, the writing on the wall. Any questions or comments so far? So good, I hope. Okay. All right. Let's move along. Okay. So the next discussion, I want to go through the mystery of the Masa, which is another area where there is somewhat of a misunderstanding, but I want to move through this quickly. There's a lot to cover today. Masa. I mentioned before the Masa Bakery, the real highlight is the Masa Bakery with hundreds of kids, but where does, and we always tell them, where does Masa come from? And we ask them, where does Masa come from? So the question is this, we'll start with something else. What is the common, what do plastic, penicillin, and pacemakers have in common? Aside from them all beginning with the same letter. What else do plastic, penicillin, and pacemakers have in common? Anybody knows how plastic was invented? It's by mistake. Plastic was an unintentional, was a mistaken invention. Penicillin was also was discovered by mistake. Pacemakers as well was also discovered by mistake. Another interesting, another P which was the object beginning with P which was discovered by mistake is potato chips. And they say that there was, supposedly what happened was there was a chef who had one of his patrons kept on sending back the potatoes, complaining they were too soggy. So he got so angry, he just cut them into real thin slices, threw them into the oil, threw on a bunch of extra salt, and then gave them back to him. And that's the beginning of potato chips, supposedly. I don't know. You know, all the details in this, you can go to Rabbi Google, and you'll see where this all comes from. Anyway, so most people, when they ask, how did matzah come about? Well, matzah came about by accident, right? The Jewish people left Egypt, and the dough was on their back, and they were running, it was too hot. Masa came about by accident. In fact, the Torah seems to support this notion. Page number 9, text 5a.
They baked the dough that they had brought out of Egypt into Masa rounds. For it had not living in it. Because they were driven out of the Egypt and could not delay.
Okay, so the Torah seems to support this. They were driven out of Egypt. They couldn't delay. So the matzah was baked on their backs. And that's how the matzah turned into matzah. Problem is, text 5b is a command that was given to the Jewish people while they were still in Egypt. While they're in Egypt, the night before they left Egypt, they have this commandment of text 5b. Howard, please.
During this night, they shall eat the meat of the paschal lamb. It shall be roasted over fire and eaten with matzah and bitter herbs.
Paschal lamb, the night before they leave, should be eaten with matzah and mar, matzah and bitter herbs. So they had matzah before. So they intentionally baked matzah. So where does matzah come from? Was it baked? Was it eaten the first night of Passover in Egypt before they left? Or was it baked on their backs as they left, unintentionally? Which one is correct? Obviously, they had the concept of the matzah before. Now, those who say that while they were in Egypt, all they ate was matzah. In fact, because the Egyptians wanted to give them a food which would be tough to digest, so that They would feed them matzah, which is hard to suggest, right? Some of us are still digesting the matzah from last Pesach, right? So they gave them matzah, which was tough to digest, so that they could work without having to stop for too many lunch breaks, for too many breaks to eat. So they were eating matzah all along. So what does it mean that the matzah was it intentional or unintentional? So there's an interesting response from the Abu Daraham. There's a biography of each of these individuals is on the side of the page, in text 5c, explaining what exactly the matzah was.
The Jews were commanded to eat matzah before the Exodus because of what would transpire afterwards. God, who knows the future, knew that the Jews would need to leave Egypt in a hurry. They would not have time to bake leavened bread, even if they wished to do so. He therefore commanded them to eat the Paschal lamb together with the matzah.
So, what this means is strange, that the matzah which we had in Egypt, we already knew in advance, imagine knowing in advance of something which will unintentionally happen. It almost seems to be a contradiction. If you know in advance, then how could it be unintentional? But that's the understanding here, that God told them to make matzah, knowing that the next morning they would try to make bread before they leave. Right? When we travel, we take our food seriously. We go for a 2-hour trip, we pack a suitcase of food. And they were going, they didn't know for how long they were going. They ended up going for 40 years. But God knew that the food would be, that the dough would turn into matzah, so therefore there was an obligation to eat matzah already the night before. So was matzah an unintentional invention? I don't know. The night before it was and it wasn't. We ate it first intentionally, and then it was given to us again unintentionally. And at a deeper level, matzah represents humility. This is what the Kabbalah says. The Kabbalah teaches that what is the significance of the matzah? The matzah is thin, the matzah is humility. The Jews were humbled already while they were in Egypt because of text number 6, which we say in the Haggadah. We also did the Haggadah. I believe that the Seder was considered the most attended Jewish event. More than high holiday services is the Seder. So we all sit at the Seder, so perhaps these words are familiar to you. Text number 6.
The Supreme King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He, revealed Himself unto the Jews and redeemed them.
So, even before the redemption, the Jews had to have a certain humility. The Jews had to be ready for the redemption. Going out of Egypt began a series of miracles, the splitting of the sea, which led to the giving of the Torah. But even before they left, they had to have a certain humility. And when God revealed Himself to them on Passover, even before they left, it humbled them. And that humility was expressed in the foods which they were commanded to eat, one of which was a very flat bread. The flat, or the thin bread, represents humility, which today we still eat the matzah, which must be baked in a short period of time. So traditionally we know the matzah has to be baked in the duration of 18 minutes. Practically though, the machine-made matzahs are baked there in the matzah bakeries in New York or in Israel. The matzahs are placed in the oven for less than 30 seconds. These ovens are set up at such a high intense heat that if they're in there for more than 30 seconds, the matzahs get burnt. But the maximum is 18 minutes. Because of the two matzahs that they had. It's really commemorating two different matzahs. We commemorate the matzah that they ate for the meal in Egypt, as well as the matzah which we consumed when we were running out, which was baked in the sun on our backs.
Right.
Yes?
Matzah baking for 18 minutes, and how much it takes to cook the lamb? But they were in a hurry.
That night, well, they knew that night they had to eat, so they had to cook the lamb. I'm not sure how long it takes to make the lamb. I believe significantly longer than 18 minutes. But the process of the lamb began earlier, and then as soon as they finished the meal, it was a rush. But I'm assuming they cooked the lamb completely and ate it, and then they started out. That's what it was. Because also, that night was a tremendously eventful night. The middle of the night is where we have the killing of the firstborn. The death of the firstborn is Chatzos, is midnight of that night. So there's a lot going on. It's a hectic scene. And they knew in advance that this was a special night. They didn't necessarily, and then when the death of the firstborn, the tenth plague happened, then Pharaoh comes in the middle of the night, runs to Moses saying, go, and then they all leave. So perhaps it was after they finished the meal where the process, where the rush to get out happened. Another interesting point, which is mentioned on text number 12, is that the general understanding the Jewish people cross, you hear all the time, we crossed the Red Sea, right? The splitting of the sea, we crossed it. But the commentaries, when they analyze the travels of the Jewish people, it becomes evident that they didn't cross the Red Sea. They actually went into the Red Sea, the sea was split and made a U-turn, came out basically on the same side. I don't have a chart for it, but it's interesting that they all, there was actually 12 different sections, they all went in, and instead of crossing it, they went around. I mean, if you look at a map today, to go from Egypt to Israel, you don't need to cross anything. You can walk it, right? You walk through the Sinai Desert and you're in Israel. So they went through a U-turn through the sea, which tells us that the purpose of going through the Red Sea wasn't to cross it. It was that the Egyptians behind them would perish in the sea. That the army chasing to kill them would perish in the sea. So that was the purpose. They didn't cross the sea. They went in, came out on the same side. And again, Kabbalah talks extensively about why this was the form, this was the miracle that was used for the annihilation of the Egyptian army at the time. Okay, that is a discussion on Pesach. Let's move along a little bit to the next topic, and that is, can someone please share what is wrong with this picture? Any ideas or guesses? What is wrong with this picture? I'm sorry? There's one. I believe that this is supposed to look like two. I think even Rembrandt, there's just one behind the other.
It's too small.
What? They're a little bit too small. Okay? The size is going to be an important matter. Although it's hard to tell what is the definition of size, because everything is relative to the picture, to the painting.
More than 5 commandments on one tablet.
Yeah, we don't want that. We don't want more. Have enough evidence. But not maybe. Okay. I wonder what that. No, I see that he starts under a little tirsa. This would be the second one, which includes the last four. Which includes the last five. The last one happens to be a longer one. Alright. So first, where does the idea of two tablets come from? Where did two tablets? So this is a film. I'm not sure where this comes from, exactly where the idea of two came from.
Oh Lord, why have you chosen me? What could you have me do for you? I shall give you my laws, and you shall take them unto the people. Yes, Lord! Lord, I shall give these laws unto thy people. Hear me! Oh, hear me! Oh, pay heed! The Lord has given unto you these 15. Ten!
Ten! That's a fact which many people are unaware of. Now we went from 15 to 10. Alright, but what is the mistake? So there are actually several mistakes. Well, there's one which is the most common mistake when it comes to the tablets is that the top of the tablets are rounded. And generally, we see the tablets in all synagogues and all Jewish events. The tablets become perhaps behind the Star of David, or the most prominent Jewish symbol. And the tops, almost always you'll see them rounded, which is a mistake. The stones were not rounded. And the second mistake, you mentioned the size, is that in almost all situations, it is not a perfect square. And the Torah, when the Talmud analyzes the dimensions of the luchos, of the tablets, they were two perfect squares. And they were made of sapphire, but you had the Torah, the Talmud derives, let's go first to text 7b. I'm sorry, first 7a, where the Talmud describes the length and width of the tablets.
Not sure where we're going. The tablets were 6 handbreadths long, 6 handbreadths wide, and 3 handbreadths deep.
So what is a handbreadth? The handbreadth is generally understood to be 3.15 inches. I know many people say it's like this. 3.15 inches. That's the definition, which makes the luchos in inches would be 19 inches by 19 inches by 9.5 inches. I'm not sure if you want to measure what that would be. It measures a foot, however you come to it. That's what it is. 19 inches by 19 inches. Perfect square. It's not taller than it is wide, and both of them were the same, and they were flat, according to all opinions. They were, there's different understandings regarding what exactly the handbreadth, but there's no question they were square, they were not rounded. And the Talmud goes on to describe a little bit further, in text 70, not the Talmud, one of the commentators, what's the significance of this number, nothing. What is the significance? The Torah is made up. In general, it's made up. There's different aspects of Torah. In general, it says there's the four aspects of Torah: Pshat, Remez, Rush, and Sod, which means there's the practical aspect of Torah, the mystical aspect of Torah, the secrets of Torah, the hints of Torah. There's four different ways we can approach Torah, all of which are correct, and none of which are contradictory to one another. It would be almost as if you had a room bathed in light, and this room had four windows. One was yellow, one was blue, one was green, one was red. And from each window you look in, you'd see a different color. But it's really the same object from a different perspective. So Sutara is different perspectives of Torah. There can't be different opinions. There can't be contradictory. Different perspectives. So one of the perspectives is the secrets contained within Torah. So practically, Torah is simply telling us the dimensions of the Luchos. But what is the secret to this dimension? What is the secret? So the Rabbeinu, the Chaya, explains in text 7b something unique.
The tablets were square, 6 handbreadths long, 6 handbreadths wide. If you study the dimensions of the tablet, the height, width, and depth, you will find that each tablet contains 108 cubic handbreadths.
And the number 108 is the numerical value of the word chok, which means statute. Numerical value is that Hebrew letters have numbers, number values, and perhaps the most common numerical value which we are familiar with is chai. The chai is 18, because yud is 10 and ches is 8. So also here we have a ches, which is 8, but kuf is 100. So it's 108 means statute. The Torah is a book filled with statutes. The Luchos were 10 statutes, and 108, if you add up the different, we mentioned the handbreadths, how many cubic handbreadths were there, is 108 cubic handbreadths. This, he says, is the secrets which is contained in the numbers. And perhaps in the fifth class, where we're going to talk about language, we'll get more to this idea of the numbers and the different hints and the codes of the Hebrew language. So this too is unique. Now, where did the rounded Luchos come from? Where do the rounded tablets come from? Why has it become so prevalent? So, one of the ideas regarding that is that it used to be in Europe. Any Jewish book that was printed needed to have the stamp of the government allowing it to be printed, to be put to print. And that stamp was a stamp of Luchos. That was a stamp, the government stamp. And that government stamp of the two tablets were rounded. And so therefore, because that stamp appeared in every one of the Jewish books, so that gained prominence, and that gained acceptance, that this is the way the Luchos were. But the Luchos, in truth, was square. Another mistake in regards to dimensions is regarding the menorah. Perhaps some of you have been in Israel, what's the name of the square where it has a menorah, exact replica of the menorah, the temple menorah, the cardo, right?
Yeah.
It's a cardo, just in the cardo. So over there, there's, in the glass case, is a replica of the menorah. Now, the replica of the menorah is rounded, which is when most people envision the menorah in the temple, it's rounded. And a lot of that is based on the sketching or the etching in the wall of the arch of Titus, which Titus built the arch as a victory symbol for his victory over Israel and over Jerusalem, and the etches are of the Jewish people carrying the menorah out of the temple, carrying the menorah into exile with them. And that sculpture, that etching, it is rounded. And therefore, the general understanding is the menorah is rounded. And there is a minority of halachic authorities who seem to follow that it was rounded. However, if you look at Maimonides' drawing of the menorah, as well as most of the authorities and those who study the dimensions of the temple and all the vessels therein, most of them come to the conclusion that the menorah was diagonal. Now, even though this is Maimonides' actual handwriting, is not exactly because of the size, so you have to condense them into one small piece of paper, but the fact that it was diagonal is exact, and therefore the menorah in the temple was diagonal. There were 7 branches, and the 3 on each side were coming out diagonally and not rounded, as is what most people imagine them to be. Okay, moving right along to another major misconception, and that is, we all are very obviously aware of the fact that Jewish people have horns. This is a given fact, right? And although in Jewish communities, that's not a That's not a prevalent thought, but today, even in some places in America, I heard from a rabbi who said he was in Portland, Oregon, and someone came over to him, and he was certain that his yarmulke was there to cover the horns, and that's what it was, right? So, you go onto Google, you type in, do Jews have horns? You see 3.5 million responses, and this is a major topic of discussion, which is interesting. I mean, where did such a thing come from, that the Jewish people have horns? And if you go back 100 years, I mean, it was obviously much more prevalent, such an idea. So where does this come from? So this is a painting, this is a sculpture by Michelangelo. And this is a sculpture of Moses. And he depicts Moses, well, we very clearly seem to be, with different horns protruding from his head. Where does this come from? It comes from a verse in Shemos, in Exodus, which talks about Moses descending from the mountain. Text 8a. Karan. Close, right. Karan.
Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, and behold, the skin of his face was radiant, and they were
approached. So he had radiance because of Karan. Some of you may be familiar with Hebrew, and the horn of an animal is called a keren, the same root. And the truth is because of a certain similarity. Karan is a ray, and a keren is a horn. So therefore, we mentioned earlier that the Torah was translated first into Greek, and from Greek into Latin, by it was called the Vulgate, translated by Jerome. So his translation is text 8b, the translation of that pasuk on page 15. Go ahead. Oh, read.
And when Moses came down from Mount Sinai and held the tablets of the testimony, and knew not that his face was horns from his conversation.
Ah, so you see, he did not know that he had horns. Which, by the way, it's interesting that this picture, this painting, would be wrong anyways, because it doesn't say that the horns were protruding from, even if you want to translate it as horns, it doesn't say horns were protruding from his head, it says from his face, Karn or Pana, his face had horns. So this would be wrong regardless. And there are those who say that this wasn't intended to be horns. This was intended to be, supposed to be, a ray of light. Some of you may look at this and say it's just a bad hair day. But for those who say that it was supposed to be rays of light. Some of you also wanted to do it so that when the sun would rise, it would protrude as rays of light. Either way, this became, because of this translation, because of the sculpture, this became very popular thought that Jewish people have horns. And that's where the mistake comes from. Now, something interesting regarding this episode, again, to take this a little bit deeper, why is it that Moshe Rabbeinu at that point, that Moses comes down and is radiant? What was unique about that situation? Moses was radiant. Moses had spoken to God before, and yet it's precisely this event, this situation, where Moses' face is radiant. Why is that? So this is a description of when Moses comes down with the second tablets. Just to give a very short synopsis, Moses comes down, the holiday of Shavuot, comes down with the first tablets, the sixth day of Sivan. He sees the Jewish people are sinning, and he throws the tablets and breaks the tablets. Not the third tablet, he breaks the two, and those are broken. So then he goes back up on the mountain for 40 days, and then he comes down, and then he goes up for a third set of 40 days, begging for God's forgiveness, because the Jewish people worship the golden calf, and God originally said, we'll just wipe out the Jewish people. He says, Moses, I'll wipe out the Jewish people, and I'll make your children a nation. And Moses goes up and begs for God's mercy. And the third set of 40 days begins with Rosh Chodesh, the first of the month, the Hebrew month of Elul. And he comes down at the end of those 40 days with the second set of tablets. On what day? On Yom Kippur. He comes down with the second set of tablets, which symbolizes that the Jewish people have been completely forgiven. And this is the root, this is the reason for us celebrating Yom Kippur every day, every year on that day. Because it was that day where we were forgiven from the first and greatest sin, the sin of the golden calf. And it's at that point where Moses has a radiance, or these horns, or these rays which are emanating from his face. Why is that? Moses was holy all along. He never made a mistake. But the point is that Moses represented the Jewish people. A leader is one who represents his people. And at this point, the Jewish people had truly returned, had repented from their mistake. And if there's one thing which is greater or holier than perfection, it's being able to overcome a mistake. And this is the point where the Jewish people had made a mistake. They made a terrible mistake. They worshipped the golden calf. But they had repented. And therefore the Jewish people were on a much higher level, much more spiritual level, than they were before they sinned. Because now they made a mistake. Almost like in a relationship, if a relationship goes through a rough patch, but you're able to mend it, and really truly mend it to the way it was before, then that relationship is much stronger. And therefore, it's at this point where Moses' face is radiant, because it has the radiance of tshuva, the radiance of repentance. And that's what the Talmud describes in text number 9, Talmud Tractate Brachos, on page 16. Go ahead, read it, please.
The spiritual Christ is by those who repent and not be ashamed, even by those who are perfectly righteous.
There you go. So the idea of tshuva, the idea of repentance, brings a much higher level. Moses reflected the Jewish people who had, to that point, stood at the level of Bali tshuva, those who repented, and therefore there's a much greater light. Again, a message which we can definitely take home with us, a message we can relate to, not to be deterred by mistakes, and not to think that when I've made a mistake or I've done something wrong, so that's the end of it. On the contrary, it gives us an opportunity to build a much stronger relationship. And who knows, maybe we'll have rays emanating from our faces, perhaps. I don't know. The next discussion I'd like to point upon as we're moving along. Again, I hope that if anyone does have questions, please don't hesitate to ask. We're going to go into a translation of the Torah. A lot of this is, as we see, a lot of this discussion is based on how the Torah is understood. Another area which was misunderstood and remains misunderstood by many people is the verse, an eye for an eye, which is a common phrase, which is based in the Torah, where the Torah clearly says that one who knocks out someone's eye, takes out someone's eye, shall be punished, an eye for an eye. Which loosely understood or translated would be, or literally translated would be, that this person took out someone's eye, therefore we take out that person's eye. And many people understand the Torah to be that way. Many people therefore deduce that the Torah is barbaric. It says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand, an arm for an arm. Is that what the Torah is saying? Does the Torah recommend that form of punishment? It's interesting, the Torah does have a different system of punishment. The Torah doesn't mention prison. There may have been prisons in Israel and by the Jewish courts, but the Torah doesn't mention prison. That's the topic for a different discussion. But the point is, the Torah seems to say an eye for an eye. And then the Torah says a life for a life. However, there is, if you look at the words immediately prior to the words a life for a life, it clearly tells us that an eye for an eye can't be taken literally. Because what does the verse say? Leviticus, and I believe you have this in page number 17, it says, Umake nefesh behema yishalmena. One who slays an animal that belongs to another shall pay for it. Nefesh tachas nefesh, a life for a life. So which is it? First it says you should pay for it, which means you pay compensation. Then you say a life for a life, which is it payment or do you kill the animal? So from here it can be deduced that a life, tachas doesn't mean for a life, it doesn't mean the equivalent of the same object. It means you pay the amount of payment or the value of that object, which is the topic of discussion in the Talmud. What is the value of a broken arm? That you say, an arm for an arm, so you don't literally mean you take away the arm, but you pay the value. And there's a whole system to be able to deduce, what is the value of an arm? What is the value of a life? So I grew up in a family of 10, and my parents always told us that, you know, we're millionaires, because each one of our children are worth $1 million. So then, at some point, one of my younger sisters suggested that we should probably sell one of the kids to make it easier for the other nine. You know, it's worth it. One of the people could sell. You know, so what is a person worth? What is the worth of what is the worth of an arm? What is the worth of an eye? An eye for an eye. So the Talmud discusses that, but there's no doubt that it doesn't literally mean an eye for an eye. Besides, it wouldn't be even theoretically, it wouldn't make sense an eye for an eye, because one person's vision is greater than another. So to take out one person's eye for another person's eye, you're not necessarily taking out an equal thing, but there's an interesting observation about the word tachas ayin, nefesh, tachas nefesh, the nefesh instead of, which literally means under. Tachas in Hebrew means under. So the Gra, who is one of the commentaries, he says, if you look, what does under mean? He says, beneath. If you take the word nefesh, I'm sorry, ayin, tachas ayin, an eye for an eye, and if you follow it this good, if not, it's alright. But ayin, the Hebrew letters ayin, are ayin, yud, and nun. If you take the three letters immediately under them, then the letter under B is C. So the letter under Ayin and under Yud and under Nun make up their Pei. The letter under an Ayin is Pei. The letter under a Yud is Kaf. And the letter under a Nun is Sama. So these are the three letters under the Ayin. Ayin, Tachas, Ayin. What are the letters which are under an Ayin? And these letters make up the word Kesef. I don't know. Yeah, Kesef. Which means value, which means money. So it says if you take the letters under the Ayin, the letters immediately afterwards, you come up with the word Kesef, which means monetary value. So that's just a hint where with this name. Which leads us to a very important perhaps conclusion of what the various topics we just mentioned. So now we've just suggested different places where the Torah can be translated one way or another way. Karam, does it mean horn or does it mean ray of light? Ayin tachas ayin, does it mean an eye for an eye? Does it mean an eye or it mean compensation of an eye? And there are many such examples of understanding exactly how Torah is. And it's for this reason that when we talk about Torah, together with the written Torah, Torah cannot be accepted alone. One has to accept the oral tradition together with the Torah. And the only way one can accept Torah is that one must recognize that when Moses received the written Torah, together with that, there was an oral tradition passed down to Moses. How you can understand this? Because Torah alone, if one just reads the Torah, it is almost impossible to come to a clear understanding of what it is. So it must be given with an oral tradition. That oral tradition was passed on. We talk about the chain of tradition. We talk about tradition, the Mesoras, and Hebrew. So important in Judaism was that Moses passed it on to Joshua, and Joshua to the sages, the sages to the Nevi, and the Namchik Nesago, and there was a clear chain going directly back to Moses, which is why Judaism was always the emphasis on smicha, which means ordination. But true smicha ordination was becoming a link in the chain directly back to Moses. Why is that important? I mean, after all, if we have the five books of Moses, why do I have to be a link in the chain back to Moses? I could read the Torah and I'll become an expert. Because together with the Torah itself can't be understood on itself. Why can't it be understood on its own? So there are three basic reasons why, if you open the Torah, by the way, throughout history, there have been different groups which rejected the oral tradition. They said, we will only accept the written Torah. And so we have in the Talmudic era, we have the Karaites, or the Sadducees, I'm sorry, the Sadducees was the first group, who only accepted the written Torah, said, we reject the oral tradition. So they didn't celebrate Hanukkah. Hanukkah is not in the Torah. Hanukkah is a rabbinic holiday. They rejected Purim. They rejected all sorts of various, very interesting areas which they rejected because it's not clearly in the written Torah. Afterwards, there were the Karaites. Today in Israel, there's a tiny fledgling group of people who still cling. There's, I think, one small synagogue in Israel, the Karaite synagogue. But the reason why these movements didn't last is because the Torah, if you just read it directly without following a tradition of how it should be understood, it's very hard to understand for three primary reasons. The first reason is, perhaps some of you are familiar with Amelia Bedelia, right? So the first reason is because many of the words have several meanings. So you may misunderstand the meaning of the words. So Amelia Bedelia put the lights out. She understood, put the lights out. You take the light bulb, you hang them out. Right? And this is the same problem exists in Torah. And if you take every word literally without trying to understand what exactly is the meaning of this word in this circumstance, in this situation, and it can't be up to each individual to determine that, there has to be one general way to understand it, which is passed on from Moses. And the second most common word in Torah is the word key. Now the word key has four different interpretations, has four different meanings to it. The word key means if. The word key means only. Key also means lest you shall. And key means because. That word key has four words, which is mentioned in Torah 4,000 times. And there are four different meanings to the word key. So when the Torah says ki tomar, tomar means say. Ki tomar could have four different meanings. It could be if you say, when you say, because you shall say, and if in case or lest you shall say. And this is there are some significant differences between key. One of the most practical differences, or the word im as well, is that the word im could mean if or it could mean when. So the Torah says, im talve, kesef talve esami. If you will lend if you will in kesef, if you will lend money. So the Talmud says that that word in doesn't mean if. In that circumstance, it means when. Which comes to a very practical halachic difference, is that if you say when you will lend, the Torah is saying you must lend. If someone is in need and they ask for a loan and you can provide it, you have an obligation to give it. Because the Torah, because the translation of the word in means when. If the translation would mean if, then the halakha would be that if you choose to do so, the Torah is saying you have an option to do so or not to do so. So the first reason why the Torah becomes difficult to just take literally without an oral tradition together with it is because words have several meanings. The second problem is that the Torah has no vowels. In Hebrew, there's no vowels. So imagine an English word without any vowels. So what could this word, adding vowels to this word, what is this word? Any suggestions? What vowels could you ask? Maybe I know people like Scrabble. Bird? Board? Baird? Bard, right? So you can add as much as you want. You have board, you have bread, you have bear, bard is the word. You have all sorts of different escalations, and this is the way the Torah is. There's no vowels in Torah. There's no vowels which leave room for different understandings. Isha in Torah could mean a woman, but it also could mean her husband. The same word, Isha, and that's not even pronounced differently. It's just the way you pronounce the hey, it's Isha or Isha. Does it mean a woman? Does it mean her husband? So therefore, again, you read through the Torah without any oral traditions understand what it is. You don't understand. And finally, the third reason is there's missing punctuation. If you look in the Bible of the Torah, when I talk about the Torah, today we open up a book of Torah. It's already translated and it's put into verses, into chapters. Open up the book of Torah, the five books of the Moses, the Torah scroll. There's no vowels, there's no pronunciation, there's no period, there's no dots. And without pronunciation, we run into all sorts of problems, right? So, for example, and this would seem to be pretty barbaric, but if you add a little comma, all of a sudden the story's a little bit different. It's a lot nicer, and there's all sorts of stories of terrible grammar mistakes. Eat, shoot, and leave is perhaps the most commonly known, and the mistakes which can be with the lack of punctuation. So therefore you open the Torah, and for example, a typical series of verses in the Torah. By the way, even the idea of verses, that we separate the verses. In the Torah there's no verses, there's no separation of verses. So look on page number 18. When you take a moment to read number 18, take it on your own, to read through it, see how you can come to perhaps three or four different conclusions as to what the verses are actually saying. And if you've read through this, you'll notice that it seems to be very big, but this is a typical section in Torah, without any translation, without any pronunciation, without any commas or punctuation. So then, one may ask, well, okay, so the Torah needs punctuation, the Torah needs to be given proper vowels, and the Torah needs explanation. But there's a lot more to the Torah, there's a lot more to the oral tradition than simply punctuation. Perhaps all we need is punctuation. All we need is clarity as to what the Torah is saying. But truth to be told, even with punctuation, even with clarity of where the verse begins and ends, it still requires a lot more. And to clarify this point, we have another series of verses, perhaps from the most famous verses in the Torah, which are part of the daily prayer twice a day. And these have punctuation. And this does have beginning and end, and yet still, if you read through it, it still is unclear as what exactly God wants from us. And page 19, again, if you take a moment to read, learn the activity 1b, the following paragraph is taken from the Shema. Right? Shema. You know, this Sunday, the Federation, they had a wonderful day of learning called the Day of Shema. In the JCC, and this is the Shema, this is the banner of Judaism. And yet, if you read it without any prior, putting aside all the knowledge you already have and the obligations of what the Shema is telling us, but if you read it, so why don't you read it, and then we'll ask several questions on this, what it may mean. Again, these words I should command you this day shall be upon your heart, you shall teach them to your sons, and speak of them when you sit in your house, when you walk on the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. You shall bind them for a sign upon your hand, and they shall be for tosafot between your eyes. And you shall inscribe them upon the doorposts of your house and upon your gates. So now just taking those words alone, what does it mean, these words I command you today? These words I command you today shall be put upon your heart. What are the words? Yes.
I am the Lord your God, and I shall command the Lord your God.
Perhaps. But perhaps it's only the verse right beforehand, which is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. What are these words? It doesn't clarify. Maybe it's the whole three and a half books of Torah beforehand. What are these words? Secondly, it says, you should place them upon your heart. How do you place these words on your heart? Is it literally? Is it figuratively? Is it theoretically? Place it upon your heart. Then it says, you should bind them to your hand. How do you bind them to your hand? Then it says, you should put them as tosafot between your eyes. What is between your eyes? How do you put them between your eyes? And finally, how do you put them on your doorpost? Now, if we all, each person here will probably have answers to that question. But each person here will have a different answer. I don't know how I bind them to that heart. Maybe I tie them, or perhaps there's something near my heart. The point is, we're all going to come to a different conclusion, different understanding of it. And obviously, there can't be, Torah is not, there can't be an obligation or a religion that allows for each person to come to their own conclusion of how it should be. It's not an obligation at all. So therefore, the only way we can come to an understanding of what Torah is telling us is if together with the written Torah, there was an oral tradition passed down with it. And that's how we know that when it says Quran, it doesn't mean horns, it means rays of light, because we rely on the oral tradition which was passed down with it. And only if you rely on that can you come to an understanding of the different messages of Torah.
Who separated the verses?
It's very interesting. Where do the verses come from? I'll get to that in just a moment. We'll spend just a moment. But this is a small detail. In this week's Torah portion, we talk about the binding of Isaac. And there's a common misconception when people hear about the binding of Isaac, most people assume he was a child. But Isaac must have been a child in the binding of Isaac. Abraham brought his child, his son Isaac. Last year was by an event. I think some people here were there too, where there was a doctor who said that why is it that God commanded Abraham to take Isaac when he was 12 years old? Because if Isaac would have been a teenager, then it's not a sacrifice anymore. But the truth is, if you follow the Torah, the history of the Torah goes from last Torah portion to this week, so when Isaac was born, Isaac at that point was 37 years old. So the sacrifice was as much Isaac as it was Abraham. Abraham was 127 years old, 137 years old. Isaac was 32, he was an adult, and he agreed to have it done. Just a small detail in this week's Torah portion of common misunderstanding. We're going to skip a little bit because I want to get to the conclusion of this course. What question which was raised, where do the verses come from? Where do the chapters and verses come from? It's not clear exactly where it came from, but it is almost certain that it comes from Christian sources. Chapters and verses began in the Vulgate when it was translated into Latin, is when there were verses separated into chapters. Why was that system adopted by the Jewish people? So, one of the reasons is because in Europe, it was really in the 13th century, many in Europe became very popular, was that the different towns would force the Jewish people into a debate, to Bible debates. Debate the Bible and the validity of it, the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Jews were forced to debate. It usually was a lose-lose situation. If you lost the debate, you were compelled to convert. If you won the debate, you had to leave town. So it never worked out, but they were forced into it. And in these debates, they were forced to use the system of the Vulgate, of the translated Torah, into verses and chapters, which were determined by the Christians. And because of the debates, that became commonly known by the Jews as well. So that's how that system became adopted today. Almost all Chumashim, all Torahs, all, whether Jewish prints, non-Jewish prints, are all with the same chapter and verse system, which has its source in the, some people say it was by this Jerome. Some people say it came from the Archbishop of Canterbury. Different opinions as to where it started, but it's not a Jewish source of the verses and chapters. I want to conclude with a final lesson. This is an example of the Vulgate where you see chapter 6, and this is where different opinions. There was a point where there were different opinions of verses and chapters, but most of us have accepted the that which has been placed in the Vulgate. I want to conclude with an interesting idea, a parting message and a parting lesson. And here is on page 24, we have the following question. What was Moses, the Bible to Moses, what was his greatest feat, his greatest accomplishment? So we have five options. We have the splitting of the Red Sea. transmitting the Torah to the Jews, breaking the tablets, leading the conquest of the territories of the east bank of the Jordan River, or others. So maybe we'll do this by raise of hand. Who feels that Moses' greatest accomplishment was splitting of the Red Sea? Not much for that. Anybody for transmitting the Torah to the Jewish people?
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. All right, that seems to be the most. Breaking the tablets, anyone? No. And leading the conquest of the territories of the east bank of the Jordan River? You vote for three. Three also. Okay. Let's discuss this a little bit, and let's look to the very last verse of Torah. By the way, there's an interesting discussion in Talmud. Who wrote the last verse of Torah? The last eight verses of Torah are after Moses died. Already eight verses says Moses died, and nobody knows where he was buried. And then there's several verses which describe Moses' greatness. Who wrote that? Some people say Joshua wrote it. So it's the five books of Moses, but the last eight verses were written by Joshua. And some people say that Moses wrote it. And it says God directed Moses word for word what to write. In other words, he told Moses, you should write. And Moses died on this mountain, and no one knows where he was buried till today. And so Moses wrote it with tears. He wrote it with ink and tears. That's what the Talmud says. Who wrote the last eight verses of Torah? It's interesting in itself. But what is the last verse of Torah, text 14a? I'm not sure where we're holding. It's been a while. 14a, page 25.
There has never arisen another prophet in Israel like Moses, who communicated with God face to face, who executed all the signs and wonders that God sent to perform in the land of Egypt upon for all his servants and to all his land, and for all the strong hand and great awesomeness performed by Moses before the eyes of all of Israel.
What is this awesomeness he performed before the eyes of all of Israel? What is that? So Rashi, we mentioned Rashi, what does he mention? And right there on the spot, he clarifies, 14b.
This expression alludes to the incident in which Moses was inspired to smash the tablets before Israel's eyes, as is stated, and I shattered them before your eyes.
The one other event where we find Moses did something in front of the eyes of the Jewish people, where the Torah describes his eyes, is breaking of the tablets. So the Torah concludes, Moses was a tremendous person, and his final and the greatest achievement of all is that he broke the tablets. Which is strange, obviously. I mean, what is so unique about breaking the tablets? Again, it was a terrible time. It was a time of terrible sin. Moses takes the tablets in his arms and breaks them. And this is Moses' greatest achievement. So let's analyze this, find a very powerful message about Moses, about leadership, and about Judaism, and about Torah. Text 15 clarifies a little bit of what is going on here. Text 15 on page 27. Go ahead.
This is like a king who sent an agent to betroth a woman on his behalf. The agent executed the king's order, and the now betrothed woman proceeded to engage in an adulterous affair. What did the agent do? He ripped up the betrothal contract that the king had given him. Better, he reasoned, that she should be judged as an unbetrothed woman and not as a betrothed one. Moses did the same. When the Jews committed that terrible act, he took the tablets and broke them.
So Moses, the breaking of the tablets, had he brought the tablets down and given them to the Jewish people at that moment, would be underlining their mistake. It would have made their mistake so much more glaringly obvious. God had said it's the Ten Commandments. They heard the Ten Commandments, and now it's right here on stone. This is what you transgressed. Instead of doing that, he said, let me break this document. Let me break the evidence against the Jewish people. So he did this to protect the Jewish people. He didn't do it out of anger. He didn't do it because he was angry, so therefore he threw down the tablets. He didn't do it because they weren't worthy of the tablets. If so, he could have simply put them aside. You know, put them away for a later time. You're not worthy of this, I'll put it away. He broke them because he wanted to protect them. This act was an act of protection. Now Moses had just spent 40 days studying the Torah with God. So he was up on the mountain for 40 days, 40 nights. He didn't eat, he didn't drink. He knew the value of Torah. He knew this was God's most precious gift. And yet, he valued the Jew more than he did the Torah. He valued the people more than he did the Torah, which he received from God. Why did he value the Jewish people more than he valued the Torah? So there's an interesting article written by a man named Rabbi, the person who writes today, his name is Rabbi Tzvi Freeman, who wrote a book, Bringing Heaven Down to Earth. And this is the way he describes it in text 16b. It's okay, I'm just going to read through it quickly, follow along. He says, when Moses saw the people standing below, reveling in their worship of golden calves, Two options lay before him. On the one hand, Torah, on the other hand, his people. But he could not have both. Because if his people received the Torah in the state to which they had descended, they would be destroyed. Moses threw down the tablets and saved his people. Meaning that there is something about these people that is present even when they are committing the gravest sin. Something that makes them more valuable than even the Torah, than God's innermost wisdom. It would seem then that the soul is greater than the Torah, because Moses protected the soul by destroying the Torah, by destroying the tablets. Yet, how do we know that this is so? How do we know the value of any human life? Because the Torah tells us this story. Without the Torah, we would not know the greatness of the soul of the people. So Torah, by telling us the story of Moses breaking the tablets, is telling us that we are more valuable. So we need the Torah to tell us that. So by studying the Torah, we come to an understanding of how valuable we are, that we are more valuable than the Torah for your studying. So, we have two sides of the coin. The soul cannot realize its greatness without the Torah, and the Torah cannot be fathomed to its depth, unless it is shattered for the sake of the people. So what is the story of Moses breaking the tablets teach us? And what is the message of the Torah to choose that as the final words of Torah that Moshe wrote the tablets is reminding us that the Jewish people, that the Torah is only there to lift us up. And therefore Moshe was willing to break the Torah, because at that point the tablets were just going to drag us down. So Moses broke the Torah, because the whole purpose of the Torah is to lift us, to make our lives happier, to make our lives better, to make our lives more meaningful. Of course, it demands sacrifice. But the Torah is there to lift us. And at that point, Moses realized the Torah was going to cause our destruction. So instead, he broke the Luchos. And that was his leadership. He recognized the value of a Jew. He recognized the value of his people. And he sacrificed the most valuable object in the world for the sake of the people. And the way we view Torah, instead of looking at Torah as a burden, as a book of laws, as a book of ways to make life miserable, make it hard for me, the Torah is only there to lift me up, and only there to make life, and my life better, more meaningful. And as we started the class with, every lesson of Torah, every story of Torah, contains a message in life, a message in our relationships with one another, a message in our relationships with God. This is the first topic today.